Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. This week, Richard Darn, another episode of our series from the National Civil War Centre in Newark. Elizabeth Woodworth has just published a book. She's from Canada, on climate change. It's called The Unprecedented Climate Mobilisation. And finally, Lawrence Woods is here to talk about Colombia. He's a regular visitor from this part of the world, backwards and forwards to South America. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to get in touch, do it through the national do-it.org website. Or come and say hello to People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street.
And this is one of the rooms that we've got, legacy rooms of an exhibition called Battle Scarred that we had running. And it's been so popular, we've kept these two rooms on. And effectively what we look at here in this room...
Some sort of morbid fascination of the people that come around your museum.
Well, the first thing you see here is a cadaver being dissected, or bones being set, rather. So there's a spine-tingly quality about this room, because it's about, 5% of the English population killed. Well, how many more were wounded? What about diseases? How do you set a bone? I mean, what do you do with a bullet going in? And about infections and stuff? I mean, weren't the surgeons a bunch of butchers? No, the surgeons were really, really skilled. And I think this room makes it quite clear. And some of the remedies they come with look a bit odd to us, but some are very efficacious. If that's all you had, some of the treatments, for instance, for dysentery, actually do have therapeutic value. They weren't idiots. They were not stupid. They were just people like you and I with different level of technology available to them. But they were incredibly quick at getting bullets out and setting bones and stuff. And there was a recommendation at the time for surgeons that if you were treating battlefield injuries, try and withdraw bullets and amputate legs when the soldier was in the mettle of battle. And what they meant by that was he wasn't going to feel what you were about to do to him, because there's no anaesthetic. So essentially, get him while his adrenaline's flowing and lop his leg off and do it very, very quickly. And they were good. The science of medicine really doesn't progress very much from this point all the way up to the Crimea. And certainly the surgeons that practiced in the Civil War would have felt quite at home on board HMS Victory. Places like Nelson would have looked at some of these panels and thought, yeah, that's how we do it, that's how we do it. And the other thing we can see here is a prosthesis. We know that it's obvious you've got musket balls flying all over the place, you've got shrapnel, you've got cannonballs. We know that a lot of the people on both sides lost legs, arms and eyes, particularly legs and arms. And this is a prosthesis. So, yeah, prosthesis developed in the Civil War. Parliament establishes two hospitals in London, the first military hospitals. It employs carpenters to provide prosthesis, and some of them are incredibly sophisticated. And we've had an Afghan veteran who serves on the local council here to come round here, and he's actually donated the modern leg we see in one of these cases. And he looked at these very old prostheses dating to the Civil War, and he was very surprised. He said there was one or two design features that actually would have been easier for him to use than his modern prosthesis.
On the other side of things, wars often encourage the development of armaments, don't they? And was there any of that during the Civil War?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, one of the things that the king wants desperately when war is declared in 42, he wants to get hold of the big arsenals, so... You know, that's why Bristol's important. Hull is particularly important. And, of course, Hull shuts its gates to him. That's why London was important. London's got a big armoury. Of course, London's not available to him. It's strongly parliamentarian. And a lot of arms are imported from abroad, so ports would be quite important. But we also establish a really big armaments industry here. And they improve in quality. The other thing about the Civil War is it's full of misconceptions, the idea that, you know, the Cavaliers were... You know, feathers in their hats and stuff like this, and the roundheads all wear these lobster pots. In fact, both sides wore lobster pots. It would have been quite difficult, particularly before the new model, to differentiate on a battle who was who, if you like. They fought with a similar level of technology. But cannons, yeah, they come on, and some of the armaments. And Yeah, we regularly collect this stuff from the Civil War period, and some of its quality is quite marked. It's beautifully constructed stuff, really, and very effective.
So are archaeologists still discovering things from the Civil War?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Coin hoards in particular, the one thing that people, when you've got waves of troops coming through your area, royalists one moment and parliamentarians the other, they plunder, they take what you've got. What are you going to do with your life savings? You bury it. And that's why we find hoards of coins. And around the galleries, we've got coins that have been found, you know, massive stashes of coins that people never came back to claim. Tells you about the disruption to life, doesn't it? When your life savings, you're not available, you probably have been killed or disease. I don't know, perhaps you've even lost it, I have no idea. But yeah, that sort of side of it, coins, you find stuff there, armaments, lobster pot helmets. And there's so much of this stuff made, that's the other thing we forget. The war lasts a long time. It goes from 42 right to 51. And we're still fighting after that as well. So you just think that's a lot of armaments that are made during that period. And that's why there's still quite a vigorous antique trade, if you like, for lobster pot helmets and for breastplates. We've just taken some, just bought some fine examples of plates and hats and stuff. And some of it's got dents, obviously bullet marks and, in one particular case, and a lobster pot helmet.
Yes, I mean, this is a period of our history which is still almost touchable, feelable. Buildings from the Civil War are still around, some of them. You've also got, as you mentioned, the pamphlets that were being printed, as the printing presses being quite a reasonably new innovation.
Absolutely, and I think that's why the Civil War is such a rewarding period, because there's no end to this stuff. There's no end to the propaganda starts as well, for instance. So you get both sides trying to push out their own story. And around the Civil War Centre, we've got these little sort of legends that appear on the walls, like all those names that ye crosses, them did die of ye plague. And we've also got political slogans at the time. And one particular observation by a royalist pamphleteer bemoans the lack of nimbleness of the royalist propaganda machine. He's basically saying, you know, Parliament gets its story out first, and that tends to lodge in people's mind and make the difference. And this is back in the 1640s, he's saying this. Of course, absolutely true. It's what you do. You get your story in first. You write, you set the agenda. And he's complaining that Parliament does this far more effectively, and it does effectively. It's far more adept at propaganda, if you like. And this is what makes it such a fantastic period. Just to study, it's multi-faced, there's cartoons, there's people, you know, trying to, Prince Rupert's depicted as the devil and his dogs is familiar. I mean, there's cartoons, it's like reading a copy of Punch sometimes. It's marvellous stuff, and it's rumbustuous and stuff. And when you think about the century before, how much stuff do we have from the 16th century? Yeah, well, there is stuff there, but really of this quantity, vast quantity, you know, primary sources, tracts, you know, political ideas, armaments. I mean, this stuff's all over compared with the century before, and it's just such a pivotal time in the history of these islands.
Major General Ballard ordered the retreat just hours later. Newark was saved, but at what cost? What little comfort peace offered did not last long, and in February 1644 they came at us again. We were surrounded. Stationed high above these stairs as 7,000 men bombarded us day and night.
What's surprising, we're talking about our surgeons, butchers in the day, and didn't everybody die on the battlefield of disease and infections and stuff? Well, actually, what people could survive was astonishing. One particular character, this character called William Forbes, who was a Scottish soldier, a professional soldier who served with Fairfax in the parliamentarian regime. And he took the worst part of a cannonball that exploded in the siege of Pontefract Castle. And we see before us a picture, and half his face is gone. There's a massive hole in his face. And this is why he became known as Blowface Forbes. He lived for years with this devastating feature on his face. And he went on. He was eventually killed in action in 1646, and he's just an incredible character. And it just reminds you that there must have been people walking around this country for years and years and years with terrible injuries that didn't kill them, but either deformed them or defaced them, and probably struggled to work. So there was definitely a big legacy, a bitter legacy of the war. Some of the other exhibition panels around here relate some of the petitions petitions from people that have fallen on hard times, from people that have lost their husbands or, you know, or sons have become orphans and pleading for help from Parliament.
Was there a lot of retribution by Parliament against pretty much anyone who'd supported the Royalist cause then?
There was a certain amount of retribution, and you would be named a delinquent in the terms, essentially. And in the mid-1650s, a tax was levied on royalists. But Parliament did think, well, Cromwell in this game, Cromwell did think he needed to give an explanation of why he was doing that. He just couldn't do it. So he gave an explanation. He says, oh, it's actually because you keep plotting against us, so we've got to maintain a large army. So you're paying for the army that's plotting against, which is a really nice sort of apothecated tax, isn't it, basically? But an interesting way of doing it. So, yeah, there was a certain amount of retribution. But then again, I come back to the point, you've got to live with people, and you've got to live with people who clearly are on different sides. And, you know, modern parallels, sometimes it's tempting to make modern parallels, but you can't help but think about Syria and what's going to happen afterwards. And there will be people with very different opinions that have to get on and live together after that. It's the same with any civil war. It's the same in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Council. And these rooms, oddly enough, before we had these exhibitions, were occupied by an exhibition of photographs from the Magnum Agency, a very well-known agency that covered many wars and civil wars, and we had pictures of civil wars. And we did that on the remit, that our civil war might have been in the 17th century, but it was very real and its effects were very lasting. And in some respects, we don't have photographs of it, but look at these photographs of modern civil wars, and there are parallels. And one of the parallels is, well, how do you manage the peace that has to come at some point in time?
Well, there's another side of it, and that is, of course, that sometimes troops are brought in from abroad. They were in the English Civil War too.
Yeah, absolutely. So troops are sometimes brought in from abroad.
And also, of course, big neighbours like the French would have had an interest to, we want one side to win or another side.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's true. And there are trading rivalries that occur, England trading rivalries with the Spanish in particular. So, no, that's absolutely true. Things progress on. And some of the other panels we've got in here have got some of the other petitions about welfare. And it's, as I pointed out earlier on, about what the war was all about, whether the war was just about tectonic plates of international politics or and stuff. And you look around, you just think, actually, there were implications for ordinary people, implications for the quality of life. And I think you're looking at the wheelchair, aren't you, which is an amazing wheelchair. Perhaps I should describe it to you, for your listeners. I mean, this is a... I mentioned about medicine and welfare, and particularly the 1650s, coping with the aftermath of such a bitter war. Well, this wheelchair was actually built for the Commander-in-Chief of Parliamentarian Army, Thomas Fairfax. And Thomas Fairfax was the man that would have taken the cannonball had not William Forbes, Blowface Forbes, got in the way and took the cannonball for him and lost half his face in the process. But Fairfax himself was wounded at least 18 times. Very, very brave man. And the other thing about him was, a bit like Prince Rupert, who defended Bristol, they were both very tall men. They were both well over 6 foot, so by the standards of the day, they would have been giants, which probably accounts for their authority they might have carried when they went on with troops that were much smaller. Well, this wheelchair eventually got gout, so he wasn't adverse to a bit of high living, and he needed some way of propelling himself around in his dotage. So this amazingly large wheelchair was made for him. There's only one other example that was made for the King of Spain, and it's got handles on the arms, armrests, and this is to allow him, he turns the handles and it propels the entire almost vehicle forward, if you like, with him ensconced in it.
I would have thought someone as important as him would have someone to push him around, surely.
Well, actually, Fairfax was a very modest man, and he's... yeah, but we don't take sides at the National Civil War Centre, but it is very difficult not to admire Fairfax. And he was an incredibly modest man. I've seen his tomb. It's not in Westminster Abbey. It's not in St. Paul's. It's not in Great Cathedral. It's in a very, very small, beautiful parish church just outside York, overlooking a churchyard. And his last will and testament, it says, "Don't make a fuss." And this was Fairfax's chair. And it's been... loaned to us by Thomas Fairfax's descendant, who happily is also called Thomas Fairfax, who's collected the great man's sort of drinking vessels we have here, and gauntlet and boots, and also this incredible wheelchair. It does actually bring it home to you. I love exhibits like this, because when you come in a room, it fills a room. It's so big, it looks like Looks like a bit of a joke in a way, but you just think, my God, this man must have been really, really big. He was also called Black Tom for his swarthy looks, and he was very much loved by his men. And of course, Fairfax survives the Restoration. He falls out with Cromwell. He don't particularly want to execute the king, but he's very clear in his parliamentary convictions. And eventually, come the Restoration, Fairfax is not one of the men that King Charles goes for. And you'd have thought, why not? This is the commander-in-chief of the new model army. This is one of the most senior people in part of the parliament. This is the man that's vanquished his armies. This is the man that's taken his key cities. He took Bristol. He took Oxford. He took York. Why is he allowing this guy to go free? And that's because he didn't recognise him as a threat. And he probably realised if he's going to take people like Fairfax out, there'll be no peace. Because the gentry won't allow that to happen.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Elizabeth Woodworth, and I live in Victoria, British Columbia. And I spent 25 years as the head medical librarian for the British Columbia Ministry of Health. So I have a background in scientific literature. And since I retired, I've been really interested in the subject of climate change. And I have just co-authored a book with Dr. David Ray Griffin, which actually came out December 1st, 2 weeks ago, called Unprecedented Climate Mobilization, a Handbook for Citizens and Their Governments. And I took this, it's just a little handbook. It's meant to be sold in mass amounts. It's only 142 pages long, and the publisher has agreed to sell it at cost because it's about declaring a climate emergency. I took the book to the COP22 climate summit, United Nations climate summit in Marrakesh in November, and I presented it there in a press conference, and I visited the delegations. There are not all of them. There are 195 countries attending the Global Climate Summit, but I did manage to show it to or give it to quite a fair number of countries.
Now, just across the border, we've got a president in waiting, President Trump, who is, at least by most accounts, a climate change denier, they call it. But he doesn't believe in climate change. In fact, so much that he is now appointed the chief executive of Exxon, who are probably the biggest climate change producers in the world, as his new Secretary of State. So I don't know, how much of a dent do you think your book is going to put in this problem?
Well, I think Donald Trump is actually bringing this matter to a head by denying it and having the great power of the presidency. I think there's going to be a backlash against that that's so strong, not just within the United States, but around the world, that he'll probably have to become educated about it. And this was the opinion of Jeremy Sachs, who also gave a press conference at the climate conference. He's the economist from the Columbia University in New York, and he advises the United Nations on climate change. And he said, he just smiled and he said, Donald Trump will inevitably have to become educated about this. And because his advisors around him are going to, you know, the news and everything is going to force him into seeing the truth about it. And if he ever does really understand it, he would be a force to be reckoned with. So that's the opinion of people who thought kind of more deeply into it than just superficially.
For anyone listening that has their doubts about whether climate change is really that serious an issue with, I mean, we've got all sorts of other problems. We've got financial problems, a tsunami potentially going to hit us any time, with the massive debt overhang that's going on, and the spiraling national debts of Britain, America, and most other European countries. And And also, of course, then there's the potential of war with either China or Russia. We've just seen the new, brilliant new film by John Pilger, The Coming War with China, which shows just how much the United States is building up around China, these bases, which they've done, of course, also around Russia, threatening them with war. So how would you convince anybody that can see those other major problems that climate is really as important as many people say it is?
Well, first of all, I'd say that all human activities, and including the economy, which is usually the basis for war, reside within the ecology. And the foundation for everything we do is Earth's climate. And that's not a convenient truth, as Al Gore said, for people to understand, but our economies, unfortunately, have been driving these fossil fuel emissions to an extraordinary degree. If you think of traffic gridlock in one city and how the cars are sitting there for a whole hour not moving at all, and you think of that happening all over the world, and you think of 9,000 airplanes being in the air at any given time, commercial aircraft, all this gigatons of carbon dioxide is going up into the atmosphere, and it's suffocating the atmosphere with this blanket of carbon dioxide. So the 98.5% of published climate scientists agree that we are approaching a disaster, a climate disaster. And right now, the Arctic, for the first time in our history, Dr. Peter Wadham is at Cambridge University. He has been measuring Arctic sea ice for decades. And this year, it's not expanding during the winter, which it does every year, so that in the summer, there's winter ice to melt. This year, the winter ice is not expanding. So that's a tipping point. And the other tipping point for this year is that we have the concentration of CO2 has gone up 3.3 parts per million, which is unprecedented in the history as far as we know. So these things are like the canary in the coal mine. These are disastrous developments in the last year, far more important than any war or any economy. And if we don't really listen, these preoccupations that we have with wars and capitalism and strong economies are going to do us in.
Well, you say that, but others might point to, for example, the 1600s here in Britain, where we had a very long stretch of winters, extremely cold winters, where even the Thames, which is, you know, that's a saltwater river, most of the time, you know, because it's the tides going in and out there, even the Thames froze over for weeks. So, you know, surely this does happen from time to time, Elizabeth. It's not fair to just point the finger at the fossil fuels all the time.
These two things aren't comparable, Tony. This has come upon us in the last 25 years, really. It's a very sudden change. In the 1600s, I don't think it happened so suddenly. It did happen, but it was kind of an anomaly. And this is, they can track the development of human-caused climate change just by measuring the sea ice. They stick these great rods down into the Antarctic sea ice, and they can see CO2 measurements for the last 8,000 years. And they can see that right now we've got, since the CO2 has, since the Industrial Revolution and CO2 emissions have been rising fairly steeply. They didn't rise steeply for the first 125 years, but now they are just really accelerating on a very steep curve. I wish I could show it to you on a graph. But if you look at the graphs, if your readers go to Dr. Peter Carter's, he's an expert reviewer for the IPCC, and he's got graphs on his website showing the steepness of the curve since all this extra industrialization has been happening in China and so on in the last, well, certainly since the 1990s.
So, in a nutshell, what is going on up at the North Pole? None of us really go up there. It's a place we'd avoid like the plague. You know, we want to stay in our nice warm homes.
Well, Dr. Peter Wadhams, Wadhams, if you Google him, you would get a clear idea, much better idea than I can give. But the fact is that Arctic ice has been year by year, it's been melting more and more and more and not coming back as much in the winter. So he predicts that next summer there will be very little Arctic ice because it's not expanding this winter. And as a result, the global warming moves more quickly because the reflecting ability of the ice to reflect solar heat is not there anymore. So it's an additional, things compound themselves. It's not just the ice disappearing, it's the effect of the ice not being there anymore.
Okay, well, Elizabeth, what can we do about this?
Well, it's actually interesting. It hasn't really made the news, but a lot of people now are saying that we should do what Franklin, President Roosevelt did at the time of World War II. And he actually, before Pearl Harbor, he saw that the United States was probably going to get involved in a war. And he started declaring, he declared a national emergency, which gave him unique presidential powers to mobilize the country to meet a wartime situation. And one of the things he did that isn't very well known was that he ordered, with presidential orders, he ordered the automobile industry to stop making cars and to start making munitions and tanks and so on, and with the result that they only made 139 automobiles in the United States from 1941 to 1945, whereas they had been making 3 million cars a year. That shows you what can be done if a national emergency is declared. And we don't expect Mr. Trump to declare such an emergency, but what we do expect is that people could understand that this is possible, that this, it is still possible. I researched it with the Congressional Research Service, and if there's legislation in place that will support the declaration of emergency, like the Clean Air Act in the United States, and every country has legislation where their president or their prime minister could say, on the basis of recent measurements in parts per million CO2 emissions and sea ice and ocean level rise, we're declaring a climate emergency, and so, we're going to act accordingly.
I mean, it doesn't sound very likely when you've got ExxonMobil chief executive Mr. Tillerson going to be Secretary of State. Where do people like him get off? Why is it that they seem so hell-bent on making money out of fossil fuels, where actually what they could be doing is killing the planet?
You know, Tony, I don't understand that. I really don't understand it. I think probably at the bottom of it is this idea of the corporations and like the corporate charters. And their first responsibility is to meet the requirements of their shareholders, which is to make money. So these guys, the CEOs, they're thinking that way. Like that's their mindset. And I imagine they go home and they talk to their wives and say, you know, our grandkids, what's going to happen to them and that sort of thing. But he has to go back to that office if he's going to keep that job and think the other way.
Well, it's, I mean, you could look at somewhere like Beijing. Rex Tillerson, you know, this ExxonMobil chief who's going to be taking over from Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and taking over from Kerry as Secretary of State very soon. If he was living in Beijing, he would wear a mask. I mean, they have kind of air filtration boxes in every office in Beijing. I mean, maybe America and maybe Europe is going to go down those lines because there's a whole new industry of air filtration that might sort of grow up around it all. And do you think, you know, that's actually where we're heading?
Well, that's the adaptation angle of it. Like, there are two main ways of looking at dealing with climate change and global warming, and one is mitigation, which means we stop producing the emissions, which is the only sensible way to do it, because as we continue producing them, it gets worse and worse and worse for the future. The other is that we try to adapt. And as you say, I mean, the whole of civilization could be wearing these masks, and we could be, people could be migrating from the higher sea levels, from the South Seas up into Asia and Europe, and we could have total migration disruption of all economies, and we'd be fighting like mad to try to contain these effects. Or we could turn everything around and say, look, we are going to mount a climate emergency throughout the world, and we're going to deal with that first. And not only that, but while we switch from wind to wind and solar, and we switch to the electric grid, the new green grid, we will have full employment, because just like in the New Deal in the United States in the 30s and during the war in the 40s, they had full employment. So did you in Britain while you were fighting World War II. So this is World War III. And our book is the Unprecedented Climate Mobilization, has been reviewed by Dr. Michael Mann, who's one of the top climatologists in the United States, and he recommends this approach, as do seven or eight other climate people.
Well, look, but on the other side of the coin, you've got the ExxonMobil Empower. You've also got the essentially what's been going on in the Middle East, which is a massive resource grab after oil, that is taking it off the Libyans, trying to take it off the Iranians, trying to take it off the Syrians, taking it off the Iraqis, you know, so getting in there and doing deals with much more friendly governments after the invasions of these countries. I mean, surely the power of these massive oil companies like Shell and Exxon is so now closely wedded to power here in Britain and in the United States, that there's really nothing we can do. We're going to have to wait until this climate disaster happens before people even start waking up.
Oh, Tony, I really couldn't. I can't agree with what you've said. I've been to the last two global climate summits, and the divestment from fossil fuels in universities and even Bill Gates and all kinds of pension funds and governments, there has been $5 trillion divested from investments in fossil fuels over the last couple of years. It's called the carbon bubble. Like, everybody knows that we will not be able to continue using fossil fuels indefinitely. And so and that means that at some point these investments are going to start losing money. And this carbon bubble, if you Google that, there's a lot of economic information about that. I think it originated from England, the idea of the carbon bubble by Carbon Tracker, about 2013.
Can you explain what the term means? What is the carbon bubble? Are you saying it's going to go bang?
That's right. It's the idea that the bubble, if you think of all the investments that are in fossil fuels now, that bubble is going to burst because of regulations that will be coming down. And because of these, the non-Western wealthy countries are all really committed to the Paris Climate Agreement. So they're not all going after oil. A lot of them are doing, it's just amazing how much they're doing with green energy, stuff that we never hear about because our media are heavily influenced by the oil corporations. So we don't get to hear what's going on in China, in India, in the South Pacific, all those countries. So the divestment and the regulation that's coming is going to cause that carbon bubble of investment to collapse.
Okay,
or burst.
Elizabeth, just remind us of the title of your book again, please.
My book is called, I'm co-author of the book. The other author is Dr. David Ray Griffin. And the book is called Unprecedented Climate Mobilization, a Handbook for Citizens and Their Governments.
And where would you point people to online to have a look at this?
To Amazon or to the publisher. The publisher is Clarity Press, and it's a great little publishing company. They do really good alternative work. She's a top-class editor. And I would say Amazon.com or .ca or .uk. You could get a copy of it there. They're priced at cost, because it's so important that activists be able to afford them. So if you buy 10 copies or more, they're $7 US each, which is pretty well unheard of.
Okay, well, Elizabeth Woodworth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined by Lawrence Woods. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome
to
Dialect.
Tony. Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, you're back off to... You're one of the... we have several people here going backwards and forwards to Colombia. Fascinating place in midst of the Amazon jungle, although not all of Colombia,
and
of course,
the Andes.
Is jungle, and the Andes Mountains.
Desert, all kinds of ecosystems there.
And I think... One of the main things which has been a concern of people like you go backwards and forwards between Britain and there is the plight of the indigenous people, because that whole continent has been dominated by the United States, rather like Europe, only more intensely.
Indeed, yep. Yeah, and what I want to speak about today, if you want to give it a title, it's a long one and it will be explained as I speak, is the Colombian peace process, living well and living better, and the message of the indigenous elders of Abjajala. Now, Abjajala means America, the whole South and North America, the continent, but in the indigenous language.
I've travelled in South America. One of the things they get very annoyed about is when you talk about America, the USA is America. They say, no. America is the whole continent, North and South, not the United States.
Yeah, indeed. That's right. Yeah, so basically, I mean, I'm going to start off by mentioning that very recently Juan Manuel Santos, the Colombian president, won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he won it for the peace deals that are being negotiated between the FARC left-wing guerrilla group in Colombia and the Colombian government. So he's heading up those peace deals. So this is internationally being extremely celebrated by all kinds of characters, heads of states, you know, Obama himself, Israeli politicians, all kinds of characters are applauding this highly. But basically, when you really look at what's happening with this peace process, is it's really United Nations backed and overseen plan or agenda to push a lot of culture change and to open Colombia up for greater mining of transnational companies.
Sounds really dodgy, and as if the peace deal has been used as some sort of excuse to take the resources off indigenous people.
Exactly, to take resources off and take the most important resource, which is their culture. And that's what I want to go a little bit deeper into in this talk, and that's where the message of the indigenous elders comes in as well. Because basically, I want to just do a little comparison of the indigenous people's culture, which they refer to, if you translate it, as living well. And they refer to our westernized culture as living better. Now, I'm going to explain those two terms.
Do we? Do we really?
Well, yeah, that's a good question indeed. Because basically, living well in the... And this is along the lines of the message, basically, that these elders have asked me to bring to people in the Western world. Living well is all to do with... complementing each other, cooperation. It's the way that indigenous people live in harmony with the people that surround them, the plants, the animals, the rocks, everything that surrounds them. And the way that they live in harmony is by adhering strictly to the rules and regulations handed down to them and taught to them by the wise elders of their tribes. So these indigenous peoples are very... God-conscious, you might say, people with very strong moral principles and a very strong sense of communal life, community life.
Well, that really
life.
Contrasts with a lot of our culture nowadays, which tends to be, certainly around the mainstream media, tends to be, you know, newspapers, television, that sort of thing, around a kind of cult of youth. So young people... you know, pretty young girls, pretty young boys seem to be the sort of focus, whereas, you know, traditionally, actually it's the elders that were the cultural
leaders,
custodians, really,
exactly.
Guardians
that's
of the culture.
Exactly right. That's right, yeah. And that's what you see in these cultures. And I mean, I always like to go to the point of, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, when you go and live with these cultures, which I have for many years, different tribes, different indigenous peoples in South America, you begin to see, or you see it immediately, that these people are relaxed, they live harmoniously, they get on with each other. The other aspect to look at, along those lines, the proof is in the pudding, is, you know, who created the two biggest wars in history? Our Western culture, you know, they happened here in Europe. Our Western culture created them, And the root of all of this is the difference, the fundamental difference between living well the indigenous way and living better the Western way.
Well, okay, because Bristol plays a big role here. What we've got John Cabot, the explorer, 1497 and 1498, apparently discovering the Americas, you know, going over to Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and down about, around about as far as Boston, I think, in New York, on the East US coast. And that really was, if you look at it in one way, you can see it as a kind of reconnaissance mission for genocide. There was something like 75 million Native Americans killed by the Spanish and by the English and by the Europeans.
Exactly. That brings me into what I'm getting at, which is this, it's a mentality. That is the base of the problems. And the mentality, the base of our Western mentality is a mentality of competition. That's where you get this way of looking at it and calling it called living better. Because in order to live better than another person, you've got to be, another person's got to be down, you've got to be up. Now, this
encompasses... Isn't it a sort of a class system in a way? Because, you know, you've got in the East, you've got the caste system in a way, haven't you? And you've got the class system here.
Yes, it is in one way, but it goes deeper. And they've managed to work out how to sew it deeper. And that's where I'm going to come into a very important aspect of the indigenous people's message, which is the whole thing of feminism, basically. Yeah, because feminism is something... Our culture, basically, in the eyes of the indigenous, they're saying your culture is a completely feminist culture, yeah? We have been made like this. We have got this feminist mindset, and it's all been done in the name of women's rights and helping women, supposedly, yeah? Well, there's nothing wrong with women's rights. There's nothing wrong with helping women, you know? That's the nature of human beings, to help each other, is it not? But what feminism does is, in the name of all of these, you know, apparently noble causes, it subtly... changes women's mentality and brings on a feeling of competition, which drives a wedge between men and women. Because what you've got is two extremes: macho culture, machoism, where men dominate women in an unjust, unfair way, and then they bring out the counterpart in order to have this divide and rule thing going on, this polarization game they play with us, which is feminism. So it's true that there exist injustices against women just as much as there exist injustices against men in this world. But the solution to that is not this feminist culture that we are being weaned onto, and we have been weaned onto, that we've been completely led into. So this is really important, because that's where it ties into the peace process, because there's a lot of culture change, UN, United Nations, culture change agendas via NGOs and the United Nations themselves in Colombia, coming on the back of the peace process to try and get feminism into these indigenous and rural peasant farmer communities and cultures.
Now, it's easy, two blokes talking about feminism, but I mean, I can point out certainly a lot of women I've spoken to have problems with some aspects of feminism, one of which is this whole idea that women should have equal work rights. Well, no one really argues with that, but
exactly.
Then that's turned into something completely different. It's turned into, well, women have to go out to work and they cannot stay at home with their children anymore.
Exactly. There's many different agendas behind
it. Isn't that interesting? The other thing is that, of course, in the traditional way, women stay at home, they potter about, they do quite a lot of work, but that work isn't taxed. So this is another aspect of the whole feminist movement, is that it's made much more of what women are doing taxable. It's been about actually boosting GDP, getting women into the workplace and upping the GDP and upping the tax.
Exactly. There's a whole economic agenda behind feminism, as well as a psychological and spiritual agenda to defeminize women, and, like I say, to create a wedge between men and women, create competition, create bad feeling. Yeah, and it's all done in a very nice, glitzy Emma Watson UN style with a nice smiley face. But behind it is a very dark agenda, and the indigenous being seeing things from a very objective viewpoint of our about our culture, seeing things about our culture, they are calling our attention to this. You know, hey, you've got a feminist culture. And the indigenous elders are saying, please don't bring it to us. We don't want these UN programs of culture change coming in with the peace process or in any way. Don't bring those things. The same, I have to say, with the whole LGBT agenda is being very strongly pushed in Colombia on the back of the peace process as well. And this is all part of mixing up cultures that, by nature, don't have these tendencies, never have. And now they're beginning to trying, the UN has recently tried, they've been rejected by the Colombian people, but they continue to try in different ways to make it an obligation in primary schools for children to receive very early sexual education lessons and to begin to question from an early age whether or not they're a boy or a girl in that body. So all these different things, which is supposed to be presented as being, you know, equality, gay rights, transsexual rights and all of that. But in reality, it's a culture change agenda. It's a mix. They're trying to mix up and confuse people, basically.
Well, look, I mean, isn't it funny the way that the equalities agenda works very well for some sorts of things like sexual rights, transgender rights, but it doesn't work for things like equality of opportunity and equality of pay and equality of lifestyle.
No.
You know, so you've got some people who are working all the hours God sends and haven't got enough money to pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you've got people who are on hundreds of thousands of pounds a year and have got a whole load of sort of indentured slave servants. So if you're going to talk about equality, it's surely you've got to get at least some kind of equality of income somewhere in there.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's completely, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing, basically, the whole thing that they're trying to push through.
The other thing with feminism, mentioning feminism, I think, you know, you do have to laugh, don't you? Because you think about Angela Merkel, Margaret Thatcher, Theresa May.
Yeah.
These are not what you would consider to be sort of compassionate, caring.
No, not at all. I mean, Theresa May's got her finger on the button, and she's ready and you know, to push it whenever necessary. I mean, these kind of women, she's never had children. She's a perfect example of a feminist, you know, with that feminist mentality of competition over cooperation, competing with the man over sort of, you know, love and compassion.
And she's the British Prime Minister, even though she was never elected into the role.
Exactly.
Even by 150,000 people in this country and members of the Conservative Party,
yeah.
Not a single one voted for Theresa May to be the Prime Minister.
And it just goes to show that the Brexit is very similar to the recent referendum they had in Colombia about the peace process. They asked the people, do you like the peace process or not, you know? The way they termed it with their psychological manipulation of terms was, do you want peace or not? But the way the people, luckily the Colombian people took it, was, do you like the peace process that we're proposing you or not? The vast majority, 30 million of Colombians, did not vote, i.e. we don't like either option. We don't like war. We don't like this false peace process you're proposing. A small minority, 12 million, voted, and of those who voted, the no vote won. Nonetheless, only about a month or a month and a half after that vote, they're pushing it through Congress anyway, the peace process. So it just goes to show, as with the case Brexit here, Brexit is a scam. We're not leaving the European Union. We haven't left. We're getting tied in much deeper, much stronger. And it's just a thing to create a load of economic problems and blame it on the people for being so stupid and voting for Brexit. But that's just psychological manipulation,
it
basically.
It is, isn't it? Oh, yeah, so quite a lot of insulting things have been said about the people who voted Brexit, like you did it because you didn't know what you were talking about. And also, of course, look at Greece. The summer before the Brexit vote in 2015, they voted to get out of the Eurozone.
That's right.
And they haven't actually, it's not been delivered. And it does seem that there's this kind of oligarchy that's really running things. And these referenda are nothing much more than sort of opinion polls. Well, we'll do an opinion poll and see what the people think.
They're opinion polls, yeah. And they're also to kind of rile up the nation, to create bad feelings, you know, in people, and also to ultimately, like the Trump and Hillary vote, we'll see what happens in the end. We'll see what, you know, who's who and what's what with time. But, you know, it's that same kind of thing. Get the people to vote. Let them vote and then do loads of bad things on blaming it on that vote, even though, you know, we're not leaving the European Union in the case of Brexit, for example. And then afterwards say, oh, it's you silly, ignorant people, you workers that voted for that thing. That's the reason that, you know, everything's gone pear-shaped. And it's not, you know.
Okay, what do you think the reason is?
Well, it's a load of elites in the background managing everything, bankers, Zionists, all of the elites that have got the whole show, you know, under their thumb, basically, and psychologically manipulating us via the mass media. That's what the real problem is. And like I say, ultimately, society is the extension of the individual. The world we live in, ultimately, we deserve that world. We create it because it's a reflection of what we have all have inside us. So ultimately, the fact that we're living in these kind of Western competitive societies in which loneliness, sadness, all kinds of different psychological problems are growing is a reflection of this living better mentality, this mentality of competition. And that is where you get the message from the Indigenous elders coming in saying, please, we don't want you to bring your stuff over. And also kind of trying to call our attention to maybe so that we can actually help ourselves a little bit and try and analyze inside ourselves the psychological and mental roots of our ills and of what's going on in the world around us. And take a leaf out of their book, which is a culture in which men and women have defined and different roles in society, in life, that complement each other. And they're really happy in that. They don't want feminism, thank you very much. They don't want to be made to think that it's unjust that a woman by nature does the motherly role in the household and, you know, all of that. So that's complementary community-minded mentality, and that's why it hasn't been Indigenous cultures that have created the two biggest world wars that we've seen.
One of the things I remember reading in I think it's called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. I don't know if you've come across that document. Fascinating document, and it's really about what it says is, this is I think it was found in a photocopier in the United States somewhere, and it was saying that the British and the Americans have been working on this whole form of economic control of the population, which would happen behind the scenes. And what it talks about is the idea of occupationally orphaned children. So the idea is to get both the father and the mother out to work, so the kids are then on their own,
and
the kids are effectively orphaned, and so then the state takes those children and fosters and educates them. So there's a definite, I think, a definite agenda there to basically take the kids off your folks.
A little bit
like the, you see, when it happened in,
get them all to question whether they're boys or girls in that body, you know, from a very early age.
In Victorian times, when children were first taken off parents to educate them in schools, they said, well, we will give them a really good moral Christian education. And people then sort of said, well, okay, I suppose you can, fair enough, you can take our kids and give them a good education. Great, fine. Mm-hmm. But of course, now that moral element is effectively disappearing from
what
the state
is doing. You've got tolerance rules, which are the most, tolerance laws, you know, European Union bring in, which are the most intolerant laws that have existed. You can't speak your mind, you can't speak the truth about what you think. Because you get the tolerance police, you know, you can't even write anything on social media these days because it's all being, the laws are coming in so that they can spy on us more and more. And free speech is being completely ruled out in the name of tolerance.
Well, we've had a bit of free speech, haven't we?
I think we have,
just then.
Hopefully.
anyway, can you just point listeners towards any good websites to follow up on this cultural attack on Colombia from the West?
To be honest, at this point, I'm working with some other people on getting material ready for a blog. It's not up and running yet. So what I'm going to give is an email. Anyone who's interested, please write to this email. It is livingwell@samerica.com. livingwell@samerica.com.
And if people want to follow,
we'll put them on a mailing list, and we'll also let them know when the blog's up and running.
But what about you? Whereabouts do you go to get some, you know, good, reasonable news in English language from South America?
Well, that's the thing. It's all in Spanish. What I get from South America, I get a lot of news.
Don't Telesur do an English service? I think
yes, they do, and that's got some good things. But I personally digest it a lot, because not everything there, because all of those kind of UN agendas, they're coming in and they're infiltrating all of these left wing governments, unfortunately. So you get a lot of dodgy stuff mixed in with a lot of good stuff as well.
But I think Telesur is a pretty good place to start.
It's a good place to start. Telesur is not bad, but like I say, you know, beware, because I mean, they're in Colombia. The left-wing supposed movements, basically, they're a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are completely infiltrated by Marxism. And now the whole fight for people's rights, like I say, is being invested into this transgender, LGBT agenda, and feminism, and it's all going towards that. And people are just forgetting farmers' rights, indigenous people's rights, and everything.
And land rights, of course.
And land rights, indeed, totally. Whilst the UN Agenda 21 is also being extremely furthered with the peace process. So.
Okay, Lawrence Woods, thanks very much for joining us for a bit of free speech here on Dialect.
Thank you so much, Tony, for having me. It's really great to be on.
Well, that's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Richard Darn from the National Civil War Centre in Newark. Also, Elizabeth Woodworth, author of the book on climate change, Unparalleled Climate Mobilisation. And also to Lawrence Woods, you just heard there, who's an expert on Columbia. Well, he's not really an expert, but he's from the Bristol area and he's been visiting Columbia for many years. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute, either through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, prsc.org.uk, or through Volunteering Bristol. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Yeah.